Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for an intelligence briefing on what I think of as the war for the free world. In that war, we are facing not just enemies of the humankind, but enemies of the natural kind. You could argue that Ebola at the moment is preeminent among them. I'm very pleased that we have with us a man who is at the forefront of our efforts to understand this threat and how best to contend with it. He is Dr. Scott Gottlieb, a practicing physician who formerly served as the Deputy Commissioner for Medical and Scientific Affairs at the Food and Drug Administration. He is currently a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a welcome guest here at Secure Freedom Radio. Dr. Gottlieb, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk, if we could, just for the purpose of sort of calibrating the threat from the Ebola epidemic in West Africa, both for the people of Africa and, for that matter, for us.
Well, right now, I think the biggest threat that we face is the continued spread of Ebola in West Africa to other parts of the world. This is clearly an epidemic in West Africa. There's no indication that we're getting the epidemic under control there. I think that we're at the point right now where the only way we're going to really get it under control there in the near term is by the introduction of a vaccine, which probably isn't going to be ready till next year. So the epidemic is going to continue to spread, and you're going to see probably by the end of this year hundreds of thousands of people infected there. The biggest risk we face for ourselves is that the epidemic is going to spread from West Africa to other parts of the world where we have many more connections. So if you see epidemics or outbreaks start to pop up in Latin America and countries like India, that's going to be a real strategic risk to the United States, because then we risk not just isolated cases coming here as we're seeing now, but the threat of multiple cases coming here and the prospect of more serious outbreaks here in the U.S. I don't think we'll ever get to the point where it's going to be an epidemic in the U.S. We're probably going to be able to control it, assuming the virus itself doesn't mutate, but we could have more sizable outbreaks. And as we've seen, just one or two cases in a major city causes a lot of anxiety and concern. You know, imagine if we have several dozen cases simultaneously. That's the risk we face, and probably not until, you know, maybe early next year, but there's no indication that we're getting this under control in West Africa.
A very frightening prospect. One of the efforts to help counter the epidemic in Africa, of course, as you know, Dr. Gottlieb, is encouraging Western healthcare professionals to go there. And we've been told by Dr. Anthony Fauci, rather relentlessly over the weekend, most especially from the Center for Disease Control, that quarantining people coming back from the hot zones, whether they're medical professionals or others, will have a chilling effect on people's willingness to go into harm's way in this fashion. Talk, if you would, about what it means, given that there is this seemingly irreducible 21-day lag between contact and exhibiting symptoms. How can the West, the United States most especially, contend with the possibility that some of these healthcare professionals may be bringing the disease back if you're not doing a quarantine?
Well, you quarantine people when you think that they might become sick here and they're not going to present to the healthcare system and they could, you know, run around and create some secondary infection. The reality is a healthcare professional coming back from the hot zone is likely to present to the healthcare system very quickly if they develop the signs or symptoms of Ebola, and they're likely to be more prudent. So I don't fully understand a policy designed to target the healthcare workers at the very time we want to encourage them to go abroad. And certainly we're not going to, for example, quarantine the healthcare workers at Bellevue who are taking care of the sick individual, nor am I suggesting we would. So it begs the question why we're going to just routinely quarantine healthcare workers coming back from West Africa when, in fact, frankly, Doctors Without Borders and these other relief groups have shown a better ability to protect their healthcare workers over there than we've shown an ability to protect our healthcare workers here. We had a handful of infections here in the United States, and already two nurses have gotten sick. They had about 700 expat medics going over to West Africa, and so far Dr. Spencer is the first one to get sick. Now, that said, I do think that we should be putting in place a system of more active surveillance for anyone returning from that region. I don't think we should be shutting down travel because of the destabilizing effect that it'll have. But certainly having active surveillance once people arrive back from West Africa, whether they're doctors or they're other tourists, where we do some more active tracking of them, that makes a lot of sense to me. I think what New York did this weekend, where Cuomo basically, you know, changed the policy, I think what he arrived at actually makes a lot of sense and could be a model for a national policy where when people do arrive from that affected region, if there's any indication they might have been in contact with Ebola, we're going to do active monitoring of them. We're going to send people in to actively check on them. You could be doing that with phone calls and surveys, or you could send, you know, basically boots on the ground, people to go see them. That's obviously more vigilant. And you could require them to stay confined to their house, which is what New York's going to do. But those kinds of measures, I think, are prudent. I think forcing people to be quarantined in a third-party location like they're doing in New Jersey, I think that's very aggressive, and it's going to have the effect of discouraging healthcare workers from going over there.
Let me turn to something else that you talked about. The development of a vaccine and perhaps other medical treatments for those who've already contracted the disease. There are reports, and you served at the highest levels of the Food and Drug Administration, so I imagine you've had a chance to focus on this intensively. There have been reports that we have had in Canada and here, I believe, as well, some substantial progress made towards developing prophylactic treatments or post-contact treatments that have not come to fruition for various reasons. How serious is the problem that we've not been able to bring these to fruition to this point, and what lessons should we be learning from that?
Well, I think it's a serious problem if these things have been in development for well over a decade and we haven't been able to advance them past phase one clinical trials. There's obviously a big effort underway right now to advance the vaccine. And I think world regulators are doing a good job. I don't think they're doing a very good job advancing the small molecule drugs. There's pill drugs that could be in the field right now that aren't being advanced very quickly. I think in the future we need to have a more concerted effort to try to develop resources to move these kinds of therapeutics along. When we have a therapeutic that targets a low probability, high impact type of risk, like an Ebola infection where there's no natural market for the therapeutic at any point in time other than for an epidemic, and we need to have resources set aside to do that. We didn't do that with Ebola. We've done it with a couple of bioterrorism threats like smallpox and anthrax where we've been more focused, but Ebola was on the list of those types of threats, but it was low down on the list and didn't get enough attention, obviously, until now. But I do think we need to be focused on some of these pills, these small molecule drugs, that the U.S. patients have actually been getting perhaps with some success, because I think those could be available for use in Africa long before the vaccines are.
Speaking of Africa, we have sent 3,000 or so troops there under President Obama's direction. Congress has not been involved in that, and there have been some concerns expressed about the safety of those folks, the rules of engagement under which they're operating, and the prospect that they'll be confined there should they contract the disease rather than be brought back here, whereas we're being told, Dr. Gottlieb, that there's some effort being made now to have some non-U.S. citizens brought here for treatment. What do you make of what we're doing in this vein?
Right. Well, as far as the troops going abroad, my understanding is very few of them, if any, are going to have direct contact with patients. I think that the contact that they're going to have is the laboratory technicians are probably going to be running samples where they'll have contact with Ebola-infected body fluids, but not direct contact with patients. My understanding also, and I was on Capitol Hill last week asking this question of some of the members and their staff, my understanding is that the troops will be brought back here if they have an unlikely circumstance where they do become infected. They'll be brought back to the United States. They'll be medevaced for treatment. But that's my understanding at this point. That could have changed, or it could be wrong, but that's what I was told on Capitol Hill. They do have, obviously, there is a risk. Anytime they go in country there's a risk. They're going to be coming in some contact with local folks who themselves could be infected. But I think the risk is probably, you know, fairly low.
Well, let's hope so, and let's hope they are brought back here for treatment if it eventuates. And I also hope that we will not see the United States importing large numbers of these infected folks from Africa at the moment. Dr. Gottlieb, we appreciate your service to our country in the past and what you're rendering today as an outside expert at the American Enterprise Institute on this very important controversy and how best to handle it. I hope you'll keep coming back to us with updates, if you would, as this isn't going to go away anytime soon, that's for sure. Thank you, sir. Good to talk with you. Next up, Dr. Eric Reeves, an extraordinary activist for human rights and freedoms in Sudan.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them,
when you make fun of them,
when you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around.
And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
Hi, I'm Tim McGraw. The men and women of the Air Force Reserve play a vital role in protecting us at home and abroad. They are your neighbors, whose dedication to our country and commitment to their communities call them to serve. Dedication, commitment, and service. It happens every day at home and around the world. They're your neighbors, making a difference.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
It's important to plan ahead for emergencies, like the storm. When it kicked in, we had a plan.
Separated.
We were able to get in touch with each other
and
in no,
no
time.
Idea how to find each other.
The whole experience was fine.
Was the most frightening 10 hours of my life.
If there's one piece of advice I'd offer other moms out there, it's to stay calm and keep to the plan.
Message.
Some parents plan ahead. Some don't. Make sure you know where to find your family in an emergency. Start your plan at ready.gov. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
I lost my arm.
I lost my legs.
But you can't see what I lost. Over 625,000 vets are suffering from traumatic brain injury
and post-traumatic stress. They're the wounds you can't see.
But with your help, we can expose the invisible wounds of war.
And get these veterans the help they desperately need.
100% of your donation goes toward building treatment centers. Help heal the invisible wounds of war. Donate at makeitvisible.org.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say, joined for the first time, I believe, at Secure Freedom Radio by Dr. Eric Reeves. He is an extraordinary activist for human rights and freedoms, notably, but not exclusively, in the country that he has brought international attention to for years, namely Sudan. And Dr. Reeves is a professor at Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts. He teaches English literature and language there. And in his free time, he runs one of the most important and influential efforts to help the people of Sudan in the world today. That is under the rubric of the Sudan Aid Fund, which is hosted by the Community Foundation of Western Massachusetts. He's the author of a number of books, including A Long Day's Dying, Critical Moments in the Darfur Genocide, and Compromising with Evil, An Archival History of Greater Sudan, 2007 to 2012. Dr. Reeves, welcome. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Good to be with you.
You have accomplished something extraordinary recently, and I want to commend you for your long-running efforts, but particularly for the hat trick that that you pulled off in terms of getting your hands on and translating and making widely available to the world a memorandum. It's a minutes of a secret meeting of a high-level council in Sudan, in Khartoum, and you've compared it to being able to have an inside look at the Wannsee conference that the Nazis used to plan their Holocaust. Talk about this extraordinary memo and whatever you can say about how you came by it and what it tells us.
It tells us an enormous amount. This is the first time we've had this kind of insight into the thinking and the barbarism and cruelty of the regime as its most senior security and military officials speak among themselves. I can't say much about the way in which I acquired the document. It came to me from a source in Sudan whom I trust implicitly. This person would never, first of all, he's cagey enough, he would never be fooled by a forgery, and he would never take a chance with my reputation working as I do individually.
We're visiting with Dr. Eric Reeves, currently a professor at Smith College, but also one of the country's and indeed the world's foremost experts on the human rights abuses of the regime in Khartoum, Sudan. And Dr. Reeves, you were talking about this document, these minutes of a senior meeting of military and security officials in Khartoum back in August. What specifically are the contents?
There are a number of key points to emphasize. One is that they plan a campaign of starvation in the Nuba Mountains. There's a very good sorghum crop about to be harvested in the Nuba Mountains. And repeatedly, senior officials talk about starving the people and bombing the agricultural production as a way of subduing the rebellion. We also learn that Khartoum is about to support in a strategically significant military fashion the rebels in South Sudan. This will have the effect of prolonging a conflict that has the potential to claim hundreds of thousands of lives for lack of food, clean water, and humanitarian access. We also learn, and this is quite telling, that every single member of this cabal noted that the relationship between Khartoum and Tehran is a strategic one. President Bashir, shortly after I released the document, went to Saudi Arabia to say explicitly, no, it's not a strategic relationship, but this was transparently damage control.
This is the sort of double game that the Sudanese are notorious for. And interestingly, they're playing out on the Saudis, who have been past practitioners of the art of double gaming for many years. And what this tells you and the rest of us, Dr. Reeves, is that we are dealing with a completely unreformed government in Khartoum and that it is dealing with all of the worst actors for truly genocidal purposes as it has for years now. Is that right?
That's correct. And that's why the U.S. policy under the Obama administration has been so troubling to me. Special envoy Princeton Lyman said, we don't want to see regime change. We want to see this regime preside over democratic transformation of Sudan. That's simply preposterous, and they know it's preposterous. And this is in service of other motives in the relationship between Washington and Khartoum. This regime cannot be reformed. Indeed, what we learn in the memo is that they have very elaborate plans for orchestrating the re-election of President al-Bashir next April. They're very, very detailed plans about that election. This is a regime, as I argued many years ago in the Washington Post, this is a regime that must be removed. Regime change is the only way forward for Greater Sudan.
And characterize this regime just a little bit further. This is a Islamist-based government that is deeply hostile to the people elsewhere in the country who are not. And, of course, the people who have now, with your considerable help, brought about an independent South Sudan. Talk, if you would, in that regard about the abiding determination of Khartoum to also lay waste to what's left of the people of Darfur and the Blue Nile state.
One of the things we have observed over the 25 years the regime has been in power is that it will do anything necessary to preserve its monopoly on national political power and wealth. That has led to genocidal counterinsurgency strategies. The more that the regime can turn combatants in the south, in Darfur, elsewhere, against themselves, the better it is as far as Khartoum is concerned. But they are willing to do what it takes, whether it is the massive destruction of thousands of villages and the killing of hundreds of thousands of people in Darfur, whether it is creating a famine in the Nuba Mountains and Blue Nile, or whether it is perpetuating conflict in South Sudan, which is newly independent, but in desperate shape as ethnic conflict deepens and will deepen further with the military support that Khartoum is offering to the dubious figures who lead the rebellion.
And to the extent that we're witnessing this civil war continuing to afflict the people of South Sudan, Dr. Eric Reeves, what do you mean as a practical matter when you talk about regime change in Khartoum? How would that come about, and what should American policy be?
I think we should tighten the screws even further, and most significantly, I think we should be pressuring the Europeans, who have really been dead in the water on dealing with this regime. Many of them still have active business and commercial interests there. If the euro were to be denied to Khartoum as a currency for international transactions, as the dollar has been, the regime cannot last, could not last. Its economy is imploding in any event, but the longer they are able to strip assets out of them, they sell agricultural land, they make dirty deals, they've extracted money from Libya by printing Libyan dinar. Until there's enough economic pressure, and it's there to be had, the regime will survive.
Survive, and sure that an awful lot of other people do not. Dr. Eric Reeves of Smith College and of the Sudan campaign led by the Sudan Aid Fund, thank you for the work that you do. It reminds me of our interactions years ago in connection with the effort to divest Sudan. It seems as though what you're talking about deserves and needs that kind of effort mounted once again, especially with the Europeans. Come back to us soon, sir, if you would, with updates. This is a really vitally important issue from a humanitarian point of view, as well as, I think, from the strategic interests of the United States. We thank you, sir, for your service. Next up, Congresswoman Ileana Rose-Layton joins us to talk about Turkey and the Islamic State and Venezuela. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Sunday morning's news programs reinforced concerns that President Obama's political operative turned Ebola czar will focus on spinning the American people through the election rather than minimizing risks posed by the disease. Ron Klain was not a guest on any of the five network shows, of course, but the Center for Disease Control's point man, Dr. Anthony Fauci, was on all of them. And there he was pirouetting like a prima ballerina, endlessly repeating that Americans are safe, and insisting there's no need for the quarantines imposed by governors in recent days, or for flight bans. I get that we don't want to discourage healthcare professionals from going to the hot zones in West Africa. The right answer, though, is to quarantine them, and other travelers from the region, in as comfortable a fashion as possible. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Navigating this world when you are undereducated can be difficult. I'm Dr. Ben Carson, and I know this for a fact. When I was growing up, my family lived in dire poverty, and because of my poor learning skills, my classmates called me dummy. My life began to turn around when my mother encouraged me to read. I went from the bottom of my class to graduating from Yale University and becoming the youngest director of pediatric neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins Hospital. I know how important it is to nurture a child's dream.
When I grow up, I want to become a scientist.
I want to be a doctor, just like Ben Carson.
I hope to become an engineer.
I want to be a teacher or maybe a broadcaster.
The Carson Scholars Fund is impacting schools across the nation by encouraging children to read, write, and excel at math and science so they can realize their dreams. We need your help. To learn more about the Carson Scholars Fund and to donate, visit our website at carsonscholars.org.
After all, the person who has the most to do with your success is you.
America's security and your way of life depend on having a Navy, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard that are the best in the world. Without these seagoing patriots and the merchant marine that keep our shelves stocked with the products we need, the United States could not be the force for peace and prosperity in the world. The Navy League of the United States salutes the brave men and women, past and present, of the Navy, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, and U.S. Flag Merchant Marine for answering the call to service.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them,
when you make fun of them,
when you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around. And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say joined by one of the leaders in the United States Congress, certainly on matters involving national security and foreign policy. She is the chairman emeritus of the House Committee on Foreign Affairs and now the chairman of its subcommittee on the Middle East and North Africa. Also serves on the very influential Rules Committee in the House of Representatives. She is, of course, Congresswoman Ileana Rose-Layton, and a dear friend and great guest on this program. Always welcome. Glad to have you, ma'am.
Thank you so much, Frank. What a thrill to be on the program. And it's a countdown to the election time. And national security, those are key issues for every one of these races. They may look local, but it's national security and international are standing around the world. So very excited about that.
Yeah, and that's really what I wanted to turn to. The president himself has said that his policies, every single one of them, are on the ballot. So let's talk about a couple that I know are very much on your mind, starting with Turkey. This is a country that has for many years, as you know, been a very important NATO ally. Not clear that it still is an ally in this particular context of the Islamic State and what's happening in the Mideast at the moment. Talk, if you would, a little bit about where Turkey actually lines up, and if it's not, in fact, a reliable friend and ally, what do we do about it?
Well, it's sort of odd that it is in NATO when you look at the position that Turkey has had in fighting this terrorist group, the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. We're supposed to do, a big cheer. We're supposed to go out because they relented, changed its policy, and allowed the Kurdish fighters from Iraq to cross through Turkey into Syria in order to fight in Kobani, fight against ISIL or ISIS, and gee, for that we're supposed to do somersaults and cartwheels and say, what a great ally. But it really is not, it has not been helpful in this fight against this cancer. Erdogan is former prime minister, now president, but he really is, as president, he's calling the shots figuratively on this. And it's not been appreciative of international efforts that we've been able to get in trying to get rid of the cancer that is ISIS. So they can do more. They're not doing more. And the little they do, we're supposed to cheer them on as if it's the greatest thing. And, you know, when we look at the number of airstrikes, Frank, it's just amazing that the CENTCOM puts out a press release saying, wow, today we did 5 in Iraq or whatever, and 2 in Syria, and then this weekend we did 21. I mean, when you look at our military activities in Bosnia, for example, and you compare them to other military fights, these numbers of bombings are just not enough, and everyone is talking about at this half-hearted Obama administration attempt to defeat ISIS, which is slow and painful, and we're just not doing enough.
Well, it certainly seems as though, in the first instance, we're not acknowledging that Turkey has had a lot to do with enabling this Islamic State. And you're right, we're engaging in what are at best pinprick airstrikes against these targets, and many of them in the most tactical of senses. And what we're facing, it seems, is a movement, a global jihadist enterprise that is very much still on the march despite these efforts. And if so, what does that mean in terms of the reliability and reliance upon nations like not just Turkey, but Qatar and Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates? I mean, how do you see this going forward?
Well, they can all do more. We especially congratulate the ones who've actually been doing the fighting. As we know, we were so ineffective in other places that their fighters took on the mission, including the UAE folks went into Libya and Egypt as well. And so the Egyptians were in there. So we're grateful for the help that we've gotten, but there are countries that can do a lot more. Egypt has been under a lot of pressure because these Islamic militants are out to destroy the new president, al-Sisi, and him trying to put down the Muslim Brotherhood. The UAE has stepped in. They've been helping out, and they did their own airstrikes in Libya. Where were we in that fight? I don't know. And even Saudi Arabia has been doing a little bit. But you look at Qatar. Qatar's been feeding this monster and then says that they're going to defeat the monster. They've been the arsonist and the firefighter, and it just doesn't cut it. We can see through that, and they've got to make their allegiances very crystal clear. And so far, they've been playing both sides.
Congresswoman, let me ask you about Iran. Speaking of double games, the administration seems intent upon not only enlisting their so-called help in this business with the Islamic State, but also, as you know, in pressing forward, irrespective, really, of the terms, with a deal that will have no bearing, as best I can tell, on the Iranian nuclear weapons program. Certainly won't prevent it from coming to full force in the not-too-distant future. Do you think Congress is going to have a say in this, and should it have a say in any such deal?
Well, we must have a say. That deadline is fast approaching. It is Monday, November 24th. And we know that President Obama, no matter how he's protesting, he is that he didn't say it. It seems like it's pretty clear that they want to do an end run around Congress about sanctions. I'm the author of the sanctions legislation, the toughest ones that we've had on the books that no administration has really put to the test. But it would be executive action by his administration. He's no stranger to that, and he's done it on so many issues. But we need to make sure that those sanctions are enforced and that they have a lot of support in Congress, bipartisan support, bicameral support. And we cannot let the administration do an end run around Congress and decide to lift sanctions. And this deal, we're very worried about it because Obama's had so many failures overseas. He's got to show something for all of his years in office. And no matter what kind of a deal I worry they get with Iran's nuclear capability, the United States is going to say, okay, this is a great deal. Boy, we're really tough on them, and they will accept the deal so that Obama can say, look what I got. I'm very worried about that. They're not going to let us have a say.
I think you're right on all counts. And there are reports, of course, that the administration is trying to already spin the wonders of this agreement. Wendy Sherman, the Undersecretary of State, who's made a hash up of North Korea nuclear program negotiations, is, of course, now in charge of this one. And she's out, among others, promoting this fiction that it will be a good deal. Congresswoman, let me turn to one other issue that I know you've been very engaged in for many years, namely Venezuela. It is no longer run by Hugo Chavez, but there's a successor who is at least as bad, it seems. Nonetheless, the administration did nothing, as best I can tell, to object to its securing a seat on the UN Security Council. It's bankrupt. Its repression continues unabated. Even the United Nations is complaining about human rights in Venezuela. What should we be doing about this blight in our hemisphere and for that matter, I think, on our security?
Well, it's really disturbing, Frank, that the United States, the world's strongest democracy, one funds the United Nations, that we took a hands-off approach to this power grab by Venezuela, saying, oh, well, you know, it's regional groupings and it's their turn and they picked Venezuela. Well, there is no power in the UN. And we let an anti-democracy, anti-American, anti-Venezuelan country, because Maduro is against his own people. He's abusing human rights, has no democracy. We have opposition leaders like Leopoldo López still in jail, isolated from his family, and this country, this administration seems to not care. Now they're going to be on the Security Council. Venezuela is no friend to the U.S., no friend to Israel, no friend to democracy. It is a friend to Iran. It is a friend to China, to Russia. You name a thug, and there's Maduro and the Cuba. Oh my gosh, you know that's their. That's how Cuba stays afloat, thanks to the petrodollars of Maduro. It's such a shame, Frank, to not have power and not use it.
There are few who understand better the importance of America using its power for good than you, Eliana Rose Layton. We appreciate so much your service to our country. Good luck in the upcoming elections. We look forward to talking with you after you've received a new mandate and hopefully an opportunity to be even more influential in the next Congress. We appreciate your service. Keep it up. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, Gordon Chang, talking about China. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, we have served our nation as a force in readiness.
Get some rear security.
From combat operations to humanitarian assistance in every corner of the world. No matter where the mission takes us today, or wherever our country needs us tomorrow, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for each other, for our nation, for us all, the few, the proud, the Marines.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
I lost my healthy 27-year-old son to influenza. Jacob wasn't someone you'd expect to die from the flu. He was strong, a martial arts athlete. After 5 weeks of fighting, Jacob died.
I'm Dr. Bill Schaffner of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Each year, influenza claims the lives of Americans of all ages, including healthy young adults like Jacob. Ask about vaccination the next time you're at your doctor's office or pharmacy. Visit adultvaccination.org.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, as we have the privilege of being each week joined by Gordon Chang, one of our country's preeminent authorities on matters involving Asia, and one of our duty experts for sure, as well as that of Forbes.com, WorldAffairsJournal.com, and Fox News. Gordon, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Much to cover today. Let's talk first and foremost about the assessment by the commanding general of U.S. forces in Korea, General Curtis Scaparotti, that we are now looking at a North Korea that has perfected the ability to put a nuclear weapon in a miniaturized form on a ballistic missile, perhaps one deliverable to the United States. Do you credit that, Gordon? And if so, what does it mean for us?
I believe Scaparotti is correct. It was only a matter of time before the North Koreans were able to miniaturize a nuclear warhead and put it on a reliable long-range missile. We got to go back to 2011 when then-Defense Secretary Gates talked about the ability of the North Koreans to do this within a generally 5-year time frame. And that, you know, we're coming up to the end of that. And the question is, what is the United States going to do to protect itself, its forces in Asia, and our friends and allies in the region from North Korea's obviously increasing capability to incinerate them?
Good question. The administration does not seem terribly inclined to have the answer be missile defense, certainly not for this country, and as best I can tell, really not doing much to enhance it in theater either. Is that your reading as well, Gordon? And more to the point, is that the North Koreans' reading?
The United States is doing some things, but certainly not enough, because the North Koreans are making faster progress in developing offensive weapons than we are in defending them. And of course, defense measures are always much more difficult than developing offensive capabilities. So this is not a race that we are winning. And this is going to have implications when the North Koreans are able to hold countries to ransom, including the United States. And this comes at a time when the Chinese are said to be able, on the verge of starting deterrence nuclear patrols into the Pacific. So we will have not just the North Koreans to worry about, but the Chinese as well.
But the U.S. government under the Obama administration has made it very clear, and I think, frankly, for that matter, the Bush administration before it, that they're not interested in having missile defenses capable of dealing with a Chinese-style threat, let alone a Russian one, just maybe the little bitty one that the North Koreans pose at the moment or will in the future. And, Gordon, I guess this raises the question, you've written, as have others, of the possibility that we will be once again induced to believe that we can simply have entente with the North Koreans. They are once again, it appears, under, I guess, Kim Jong-un's leadership, opening up a charm offensive. What are the prospects there? And in fact, is Kim still very firmly in charge, in your judgment?
Well, the majority view is that Kim is still in control, but I'm not so sure that is the case. There have been just too many purges and turmoil at the top of the regime to believe that no change has taken place since he took over from his dad at the end of 2011. People say that the execution of Jeon Song-tak, who was his uncle, was something that Kim did himself. But I actually think that Kim was not able to prevent the execution of Jeon Song-tak, who, after all, was his primary supporter. We got to remember that Jong was a very brutal man, killed a lot of people after the death of Kim Jong-il, and also was able to take away revenue streams from the military and from other parties. And that created a lot of problems that Kim, I think, was not able to stop. And so now what we have is Kim, who is one fewer supporter. And I think that means someone who is losing power, not consolidating it. Of course, we won't know for quite some time, but this is a story which I think deserves further attention, because we are going to see, as we have seen in the past, indications that do not point to consolidation of political control for Kim Jong-un.
And does this charm offensive that seems underway at the moment then augur unlikely to produce any desirable results?
Yeah. Normally, charm offensives by North Korea are just insubstantial. If there is a new ruling group in Pyongyang, then, of course, we don't know what the answer to the question is. Now, in all probability, even new rulers in North Korea are not going to change the basic posture of the firm's approach to the world, which is hostile. You know, North Korea has not been able to deal in good faith with the international community since it was formed. So it's probably true that they are not able to deal with us in good faith at this point. But if we do have new leaders, maybe there are some openings to exploit. This is something we always need to watch out for, because sometimes history does change. And if you do have new people in North Korea, it may mean that things are going to get worse, not better.
Yeah, well, and all the more reason to be very concerned about this nuclear capability developing seemingly unchecked by either our efforts, diplomatic or military. Gordon, let me talk a little bit with you about another part of your portfolio, Hong Kong. And again, our guest is Gordon Chang, whose extraordinary writings you can find at Forbes.com and WorldAffairsJournal.com, among other places. Also, you'll see him frequently at Fox News. Hong Kong has been undergoing for over a month now considerable political turmoil, and yet there are reports that the lack of leadership of this student and other democratic activist-oriented opposition to the increasing sort of imposition of a more mainland version of government in the island, the peninsula of Hong Kong, is contributing to sort of the inconclusiveness of this effort. What's your take on what's happening and where it's likely to lead?
Well, the protesters do have a leaderless movement. That's clear. There are so many different groups in there, and that is both a strength and a weakness. Essentially, what the main dynamic right now is that the Hong Kong government, which is acting on the orders of Beijing, is intransigent. Beijing does not want to have democracy in Hong Kong, and so the Hong Kong government is taking a very tough position because we're at that point in history where we're getting fast approaching the point where Hong Kong needs to settle the electoral procedures for the next election of the chief executive, which is the top political official. So at this point, yes, the students and their allies are disorganized. You know, they are resilient. They're going to stay there for quite some time in the streets. And this is a point where we're going to have to see whether the Hong Kong society will rally. I actually think that it will, because these protests haven't gone away, despite many predictions that they would. And this is a very good sign, because it shows that people want democracy. You know, many people said, oh, you know, Hong Kong people, all they wanted to do was make money. Well, that assessment, which is many people held, was wrong.
We'll be watching it closely, as will you, Gordon. Let me turn very quickly, we've only got about a minute left, Gordon, to the competing sort of forces at work, it seems. On the one hand, companies are having a very hard time making a profit in China at the moment, it seems, Unilever notably. You forecast that that may be bad news for a company like Alibaba down the road. And yet the Chinese are now pushing forward with their efforts to sort of supplant some institutions like the World Bank and the Asian Development Bank with a new parallel operation. Where do things rest economically for China at the moment?
Well, the third quarter numbers came out, and they were very disappointing. They were actually worse, I think, in reality than Beijing tried to tell us. We saw Unilever, the consumer products giant, reported that its Q3 sales declined by about 20%. That shows that consumption, which is supposed to be the hope for the Chinese economy, is not really doing very well. And when you add that to other information we have, it indicates that the Chinese economy is really in very bad shape at this moment.
And likely to become more so, I reckon. We'll be following that and what China is up to kind of wage economic warfare against the rest of us with you in the future. Gordon, thank you so much for joining us. We'll talk next week. We'll talk with the rest of you again, I hope, tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.